Most travelers come to Cuba for the beaches, the rum, and the crumbling colonial facades frozen in time. But what if I told you that behind the pastel paint and vintage Chevrolets lies a spiritual engine more ancient than the revolution itself? That beneath every spoonful of ropa vieja, every echo of a drumbeat in a back alley of Santiago, there's a coded language of survival and defiance. Cuba isn't just a country, it's a battleground of memory. Between colonizer and colonized, capitalism and communism, Africa and Spain, its culture isn't preserved, it's performed daily in living technicolor. And to understand it, you have to walk the markets of Camagüey, taste the sweat in a Santeria ritual, and learn why rum isn't just alcohol, it's ancestral blood. So what does it mean to be Cuban in a land still haunted by conquistadors, blessed by orishas, and interrogated by its own history? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Food, Beliefs, and Colonial Echoes. The scent of garlic and lime fills the air in the early morning streets of Havana. Down an alley off Calle Neptuno, an elderly woman stokes a charcoal flame beneath a blackened pot, stirring a bubbling calder with a long wooden spoon, the same way her mother did, and her mother before that. This isn't just breakfast. It's a ritual. In Cuba, food is never just sustenance. It's resistance, remembrance, and sometimes, survival. The colonial stomach, Cuba's culinary identity, is a palimpsest, layered, erased, then rewritten again. The Spanish arrived in 1492, bringing pigs, rice, and olive oil, but their conquest nearly erased the Taíno, the island's indigenous people, whose own ingredients, cassava, AG peppers, guava, still whisper through dishes like cassabe and mojo. The Spanish appetite came with slavery, and by the 18th century, sugar plantations made Cuba one of the richest and cruelest colonies in the Caribbean. With enslaved Africans came plantains, okra, beans, and the culinary DNA of West Africa, which embedded itself deep into the island's kitchen. You can taste it in congri, black beans cooked with rice in pork fat, and fufu de plátano, a mashed plantain dish indistinguishable from its Ghanaian cousin. But the kitchen became more than a cultural sponge. It became a sanctuary. Enslaved people would save pig ears, tails, and organs, scraps considered unfit for white consumption, and transform them into rich stews like ajiaco. In these pots, they preserved not just calories, but identity. Rationing flavor. The revolutionary diet, fast forward to 1959. Fidel Castro overthrew Batista, and suddenly Cuba was a socialist state. U.S. embargoes followed, and Cuba's relationship with food changed drastically. In a country where goods became scarce, Cubans developed an entire lexicon around resolver, to resolve, to improvise. Imagine trying to prepare a family dinner when eggs, oil, or milk might disappear for weeks. Recipes mutated, creativity soared. A cake could be made from sweet potatoes. Ground pork might stretch with breadcrumbs and old banana peels. Picadillo, the island's beloved ground beef hash, often had more soy than meat. But even during Cuba's harshest years, the Periodo Especial of the 1990s, culture found a way to ferment. Neighbors shared recipes on handwritten cards, passed down like relics. Women in rural provinces whispered secrets to coax flavor from scarcity. And in every barrio, there was someone who knew how to turn a stolen mango and a pinch of sugar into marmalade. Still, food was power, and lack of it, a political act. Belief systems. Where orishas dance with saints step into a modest home in Matanzas, and you might find a Catholic statue of St. Barbara draped in red cloth. But look closer, it's not St. Barbara. It's Chango, the Yoruba god of thunder and war. He wields a double-headed axe and drinks rum through ritual offerings. This is Santeria, Cuba's Afro-Cuban syncretic religion, born in defiance. When enslaved Africans were forbidden from practicing their spiritual traditions, they syncretized their orishas with Catholic saints to deceive their Spanish masters. It wasn't conversion, it was camouflage. Santeria today is more than ritual, it's a cosmology. Devotees consult babalawos, high priests, divine futures through cowrie shells, and offer animals, fruit, or tobacco to the orishas. Every ceremony is saturated with symbolism. White clothing represents purity. Drumming invokes ancestral memory. Possession, when a god rides a devotee's body, is a sacrament of presence. And Cuba protects this tradition, even as it commodifies it. Tourists line up to photograph santeros in full regalia, but few understand that every bead on a necklace corresponds to an orisha's story, each one tied to blood, slavery, and survival. Colonial shadows in modern architecture. Havana's skyline tells its own story. Spanish Baroque churches tower beside Soviet brutalist apartments. Mansions, once owned by sugar barons, now house three generations of Cubans under crumbling roofs. On every wall, paint peels like pages of a forgotten novel. Colonialism didn't leave, it just changed clothes. Many buildings are relics of racial and economic hierarchies. In old Havana, the Casa de Contratación, once the hub for Spanish trade, still stands. But look closer, and you'll see graffiti protesting modern shortages. La historia se repite. Cuba's architectural duality mirrors its cultural one. Behind neoclassical facades, Afro-Cuban music pulses. Beneath revolutionary murals, Yoruba altars burn incense. The ghost of Columbus still lingers, but so does the laughter of a child skipping rope beside Che Guevara's face. The tourist gaze and culinary performance. Post-Soviet Cuba reinvented itself as a cultural destination. Tourism became lifeblood, and culture became currency. Restaurants, paladars, bloomed in private homes, offering what the state could not: shrimp, lobster, rich flan. But paladars don't just serve food. They perform a sanitized Cuban identity for foreign palates. Ropa vieja on bone china, mojitos with imported rum, all while cooks shop in peso markets and doctors moonlight as waiters. This dual economy, one for Cubans, another for tourists, feeds resentment and creativity alike. Some chefs rebel by reviving indigenous dishes or rejecting colonial recipes. Others use their menus to tell stories, menus that read like poems, ingredients sourced from their own rooftops. Cuba's culinary scene today is as much about memory as it is about meals. Every plate holds a contradiction, every bite a story. The pulse of belief in the everyday walk down the Malecón at dusk. And listen, someone is playing the bata, drums, sacred instruments used to invoke orishas. The rhythm is irregular, syncopated, like a language older than empire. Inside a nearby home, a family prepares a despojo, a spiritual cleansing: eggshells, rum, cascarilla powder. They whisper prayers in Lukumi, the ritual Yoruba language preserved only in Cuba and parts of Brazil. Belief in Cuba isn't compartmentalized. It's stitched into the daily fabric. The way rum is poured before the first sip. The way a broom faces the door to ward off envy. The way the dead are honored, not with silence, but with sound, smoke, and stories. Cuba is a place where the past isn't past. It's cooked, sung, and believed in every single day. Chapter 2: Tradition, Resistance, and the Cuban soul. The rhythm of Cuba is not linear. It moves in spirals. History loops back, reasserting itself in new forms, in a dance step passed down across generations, in a chant that defies translation, in the way revolution becomes ritual. To understand the Cuban soul is to trace the island's resistance, not just against foreign power, but against forgetting. Rhythm as rebellion. In the barrios of Santiago de Cuba, long after tourists retreat to their hotels, the true heartbeat of the island begins. Men and women gather in cramped patios, some barefoot, others dressed in the ceremonial whites of Santeria initiates, as the syncopated beat of rumba drums fills the humid air. But this isn't a show. This is preservation. Rumba isn't just a genre, it's a defiance. Born among enslaved Africans in sugar mills and urban ghettos, rumba was outlawed repeatedly by colonial officials who feared its sexual undertones and its gathering power. But the more they tried to suppress it, the deeper it burrowed into the island's marrow. In every shoulder roll, every thrust of the hips, there is coded communication, a call to memory, to identity. The dance is flirtation and war. It is political. When women slap the floor with bare feet, they summon more than rhythm. They summon ancestors. Cuba's musical traditions, from son cubano to regla de palo, all carry that same DNA, the urgent need to remember through performance. Identity woven into cloth. In a tucked-away village in Villa Clara, a grandmother threads a needle through colorful fabric, her hands steady with purpose. She's making a pañuelo, a ceremonial head wrap for a newly initiated santera. The colors are deliberate, red and white for Chango, yellow for Oshun, blue and white for Yemaya. These wraps are not just fashion. They are declarations. They're worn with reverence during rituals, but also in public, as quiet acts of visibility. In a nation that long labeled Afro-Cuban religions as superstitious or counter-revolutionary, even wearing one's Orisha colors was once a risky form of protest. Yet today, you'll find these textiles hanging from balconies, draped across market stalls, stitched into contemporary streetwear by Cuban designers reclaiming their roots. The cloth has memory and power. Literacy as liberation, perhaps the most revolutionary act Cuba ever undertook, was not fought with guns, but with pencils. In 1961, 2 years after the revolution, the new government launched the Cuban Literacy Campaign, sending thousands of volunteers into the countryside to teach reading and writing to peasants, many of whom had never seen a book. Teenagers, most of them urban, lived among farming families, learning as much as they taught. They slept in hammocks, worked by day, taught by night. By the campaign's end, over 700,000 Cubans had become literate. It was one of the most ambitious educational movements in modern history. But beneath the ideology lay something deeper, the idea that language itself was resistance. To read meant to question. To write meant to assert presence. In a country colonized first by conquest, then by capitalism, and later by Cold War politics, controlling one's narrative became an act of cultural emancipation. Even today, in libraries across Havana, you'll find elders writing poems on lined notebooks, preserving dialects and idioms from towns the internet has yet to reach. Tobacco, revolution, and the working soul head. West to Pinar del Rio, where fields of tobacco stretch to the horizon in perfectly aligned rows. Here, farmers still harvest leaves by hand, drying them in wooden curing barns the same way their ancestors did centuries ago. Cuba's cigars are legendary. But behind every Cohiba or Monte Cristo is a laborer, bent over under the sun, hands calloused, proud. The vaqueros don't just farm, they philosophize, In fact, one of Cuba's most radical traditions was born in the cigar factories, the lector de tabacería, or the reader of the tobacco factory. Beginning in the 19th century, these readers would sit atop platforms, reading newspapers, novels, and political manifestos aloud to workers rolling cigars. It was an oral university of the people. This tradition helped spark revolutionary consciousness. José Martí's writings were first encountered this way, and his blend of poetry, politics, and anti-imperial fire still reverberates through Cuban identity. Even today, in some factories, lectors still read. And when they voice the words of Martí, "Ser culto es el único modo de ser libre," to be cultured is the only way to be free, workers pause, nod, and roll with renewed purpose. Festivals that refuse to forget. Every July, Santiago de Cuba erupts into a symphony of color, drums, feathers, and fire for Carnaval de Santiago, a celebration with roots far older than the Spanish language. The tradition fuses West African, Taíno, and European elements into a living archive of resistance. Comparsas, processional dance troops, move through the streets in elaborate costumes, performing narratives of colonialism, rebellion, and satire. One comparsa might depict a plantation uprising. Another might mock political elites through puppetry. It's joyous and irreverent, but also deeply educational. Children learn history through movement. Elders pass down choreography like sacred scripture. Cuban festivals often walk the tightrope between permission and protest. During the Batista dictatorship, public gatherings were policed harshly. Under the revolution, they were sometimes reframed as tools of national pride, with less tolerance for independent messaging. But the people persisted, and today, through festival, they reassert what textbooks sometimes omit: that the spirit of resistance cannot be nationalized. Resistance in the everyday, ask a Cuban about politics, and you might receive a knowing smile and a vague answer. But listen longer, and you'll hear a language of resistance that lives not in slogans but in code. The phrase, "No es fácil," it's not easy, is repeated daily. It means everything and nothing. It's a sigh, a survival strategy, a way of recognizing hardship without surrender. Or take resolver, to resolve to make do. This word defines the Cuban ethos. Need parts for a broken fan? Resolver? Need insulin during a blackout? Resolver. Want to build a business from nothing? Resolver. Behind this improvisation is a quiet rebellion, a refusal to be broken by history, by scarcity, or by state control. Cubans resist not just in protest, but in persistence, by growing food on rooftops, by turning old radios into Wi-Fi routers, by trading recipes, books, and truths outside official systems, oral history and the custodians of memory. In Trinidad, a UNESCO heritage city, cobblestone streets lead to a tiny open-air cafe run by 89-year-old Doña Teresa. She sells tostones and café cubano so strong it could raise the dead. But what people really come for is her storytelling. She recounts the Maroon uprisings in the nearby mountains. She sings the chants her grandmother used during Obatala ceremonies. She names every plant in her backyard and what it cures, from heartache to hexes. In a culture where state-run narratives dominate public discourse, women like Teresa keep parallel histories alive. Cuban oral history isn't just a supplement to the official record. It is the heartbeat of national identity. It preserves stories that could never fit into government brochures or tourism ads. In one story, Teresa describes how villagers warned each other of Spanish patrols by tying colored cloth to trees. In another, she recalls a woman who faked being possessed to avoid an abusive husband, claiming she'd been chosen by Yemayá. These aren't just tales, they're strategies their truths that found shelter in metaphor. Diaspora. The island that doesn't end today. Over 2 million Cubans live outside the island, especially in the US, Spain, and Latin America. And yet, the island lives within them. The Cuban diaspora is fiercely connected. From Miami's Cale Ocho to Madrid's Barrio de Salamanca, Cubans cook, sing, and argue in the same idioms passed down for centuries. Diaspora identity is complex. Some fled persecution, others sought opportunity. Some critique the government, others defend it. But all of them carry fragments of the island, its contradictions, its rhythms, its recipes. And when they gather, something uncanny happens. The sound of clave drumming echoes. Someone sings Guantanamera with tears in their voice. A grandmother corrects your Spanish, not because it's wrong, but because it's missing flavor. For many in the diaspora, Cuba is not just a memory. It's a haunting, a place that pulls at the heart even as it pushes away. The future of the Cuban soul. What does the future hold for Cuba? The answer depends on who you ask. Young Cubans dream of Wi-Fi, passports, and platforms. Many are frustrated by censorship, inflation, and a political system that feels increasingly out of touch. They remix Santeria rituals into digital art, sell reggaeton beats online, and find new ways to perform Cubania. Yet the elders still pour rum on the earth for the dead, still chant to the orishas, still remember which river the spirits prefer. In this, Cuba's continuity lies not in static tradition, but in adaptation. It survives not because it refuses to change, but because it refuses to forget. Culture here isn't stored in museums. It walks, eats, prays, and dances in the streets. Every day is a resistance, every ritual a rebellion, every flavor a footprint. In Cuba, the past is never past. It's just waiting to be served again, with music, memory, and spice.